All right. Thank you. We talked about the fact that this great sign of this woman who's clothed with the sun and moon and moon under her feet and 12 stars in her on her head. Listen, that's going to become very important. And I'll explain that when we get there. She's pregnant and giving birth. And the fact that a woman and the use of females is a familiar Old Testament image for the people of God. Judah and Israel are described as being God's brides, his wives. And we looked at Ezekiel chapter 16 last week. I'm not going to turn there again, but it's pretty graphic about God bringing them along and marrying and how she, then Israel, became unfaithful. Hosea was told to marry a harlot, Gomer, and she's standing for God's people and how unfaithful she was. So in many cases, the fact that there's a woman used is not complimentary when it's talking about the woman being a harlot or unfaithful or an adulteress. And we're going to see that in Revelation as well. I also mentioned last week that the use of woman, or finding the term woman, is found 19 times in the book of Revelation. And some writer had said that that almost rivals the importance of the use of the Lamb and of Jesus in the book. So your first question on your lesson sheets is who or what is represented by the woman. And by the way, I don't know if you all saw this, but I sent out another set of chapter 12 lessons because the questions that I sent out before were not in the right order. And so if you didn't have one, they're back there on the stand back there. So in our context here, I think the woman is standing for spiritual Israel. Again, we can see that she is pure. We can see that she is the faithful wife of God. She's dressed similarly to the Messiah, as we see him in chapter 1 of Revelation in verse 6. And so as she is, as spiritual Israel, she is also the sign that she is the mother of Christ, the mother of the Messiah. Now, when I say that, I'm talking about that in general. Sam, you've got some more over there. I'm not talking about Mary specifically. She is the climax of that symbolism, but as of God's bride. And if we go down to this next slide here, again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, "Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depth or in the highest height." And, of course, Ahaz is not, I don't want to have that sign. I don't want to know about that sign. And so in verse 11, and that's, I blew that again. It's still not there. So let's go back over to Isaiah 7. I did the same thing last week. I thought I fixed it, but I didn't. Even Tim said, "Is it the same?" I said, "No, it's different. But this part of it's true." Verse 12 says, Ahaz said, "I will not ask, I will not put the Lord to the test." And I don't have up there verse 14, which says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign." If you don't want a sign, I'm going to give you a sign whether you want it or not. And the sign is, "The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son and will call himself Emmanuel." So this passage here in Isaiah, I think, is the background for what God is revealing to John here in Revelation. In verse 14 of Isaiah 7, the word for virgin there, the virgin will be with child, is the Hebrew word Alma, A-L-M-A-H. And Rebecca, in Genesis chapter, I should say Genesis chapter, yes, it is, 24 and verse 43. "See, I am standing." This is when the servant is coming to get a wife for Isaac. And he said, "Beside the spring, if a young woman comes out to draw water, and I say to her, 'Please let me drink a little water from your jar.'" The word there is Alma there as well. It's the same word as you see in Isaiah. If we go a little bit further down in, or actually earlier in Genesis 24, the woman was very beautiful, and we are told there that she is a virgin. And in verse 16, that word is Bethula, B-E-T-H-U-L-A-A-H, which means a maiden or girl, respectively. They're synonymous. But verse 16 indicates that she is also a virgin because no man had ever slept with her. So we have identified the very nature of this young maiden or young girl, and that is that she is a virgin. Now, when we get over to the Gospels, Matthew and Luke also make that clear. I mean, Mary herself said, how's that going to be? I've never known a man, which indicates that she was a virgin as well. Now, in Isaiah 26 and verse 17, it says, as a pregnant woman about to give birth rises and cries out in her pain, so were we in your presence, O Lord. So this again indicates that we're not talking about a woman here. We were like that in your presence. Spiritual Israel was crying out in pain to bring about the Messiah. This is the warrior king that Isaiah is going to prophesy about in the 9th chapter in verses 6 and 7. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. And I did some study on that. It caused me to stop here. He shall be called Wonderful. There should be a comma there. He's not just a wonderful. Wonderful is not an adjective to describe counselor. He's wonderful, and he's a counselor. There are two separate descriptions of him there. So the woman here in this case that we're looking at is Eve. It's Sarah. It's Rebecca. It's Jochebed. It's Rahab. It's Ruth. It's the Virgin Mary. It's this whole line of women that are coming down through, and they don't have to be in the lineage of Jesus to be a part of that process of bringing the Messiah. It's all the women in this under this old covenant that brought all of this to fruition with the nation. So don't think of it just as the line of mothers that ended with Jesus. It's certainly not just one of them, it's all of them, but it's also the nation as they're doing this. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. So the woman is that, the labor, she's in labor. The labor is seen in the flood in Genesis. The labor is seen in the slavery in Egypt, in their bondage there. It's seen in the Exodus. It's seen in the book of Judges. It's seen in David's sin with Bathsheba. It's seen in the captivity and in the return from exile. It's seen in the persecution that the Jews underwent under the Greeks and under the Romans. All of this has been a part of the labor pains of this nation to bring forth the Messiah, the laboring to bring Christ into the world. And of course, it has been under God's close eye and guidance and protection. And you can see that here in Psalm 124. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they had swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us. Then the waters had overwhelmed us, and the stream had gone over our soul. Then the proud waters had gone over us all. Blessed be the Lord who hath not given us as prey to their teeth. Our souls is escaped as a bird out of the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we are escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. God is the one who's protecting and guiding this whole process, even through all the difficulties, to bring the Messiah. Tim?
Back to the bride, did you mention John, as in John the Baptist, where he said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom, the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, my mind is complete.
Right. Yeah, and it's... Again, John was a part of that process of and Elizabeth bringing John into the world. So there's also, and this is where I'm going to kind of get a little bit more interesting, I hope, for you. There's also an obvious astronomical symbolism in this, because as you look there in Revelation 12, as it describes the woman, we are told... that she's clothed with the sun. the moon is under her feet, and there's a crown of 12 stars on her head. And this is a sign that's in the heavens. The woman is in the heavens. And the word for sign here is also a word that is used to translate constellations. So it's the constellations were signs in the zodiac. We've already seen that before. And so here is a quote from Josephus in the Antiquities, the third book of the Antiquities, in chapter 7 and verse 7. Listen, when you open up Josephus and you see verse 7, it's almost the size of a chapter in the Bible. I mean, they're hugely long. But he says, and this is just a little bit of it, and then a little bit more of it. There's so much more that's in this text. But Josephus says, "For if anyone do without prejudice and with judgment look upon these things," speaking of the accoutrements of the priests and all the things that had to do with the worship in the temple, "he will find they were everyone made in way of imitation and representation of the universe." And then he gets down to the high priest. He said, "And for the 12 stones," the stones that were in the vestment of the high priest, "whether we understand by them the months, or whether we understand the like number of the signs of that circle, which the Greeks call the zodiac, we shall not be mistaken in their meaning." And so they understood that there was the constellations that were there. And this, again, is not astrology. Psalm 8:3 says, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have set in place," they all declare, and that's what 19 and 1 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hand." It's not just that they're there. And it's not just that they're there in their grand capacity and their immenseness. There's a way in which the heavens declare God's glory. And their line has gone out to the ends of the world, and there's no tongue that doesn't understand it, because everybody can look up and see the stars. Everybody can look up and see the constellations and see the pattern that is there. And God is the one who put them where he put them. Notice Joseph said that he had another dream, and he told his brothers, "Listen," he said, "I had another dream. And this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." So again, he's bringing up this whole idea that the universe and the astronomy of the world, the sun, moon, stars, all have a part of that. And listen, God is the one who placed the stars where he placed them and in the pattern that he placed them in. So what we have here in...
Quick question on that.
Yes.
If you added Joseph to the stars, because the other 11 were, that would make 12 stars.
Right.
Sun, moon, and 12 stars, would that also be representing the tribes then? And the,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's 12 tribes. There's 12 apostles.
And he specifically says 11 in this one.
Right. But Joseph is the 12th.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. So, let's see that. So here's we saw this already. Placement of the arrangement of the camp, and we talked about how they are in the arrangement of the zodiac. We looked at that earlier on in our introductory material. And again, they declare his glory. So John's model here obviously appears to be Virgo as a constellation. And Virgo, what does the word Virgo or the name Virgo bring right to your mind? A virgin, okay? And that constellation has in the head of Virgo 12 stars that you can see around her head. And so that pretty much makes it certain that that's what that is. Now, the significance of the stars, and that's where I'm at right now, is that they also represent the 12 tribes, as we've seen. We saw in the beginning, the stars that were in his hand represented the churches, the seven churches of Asia. And this is the arrangement of all of the tribes around the tabernacle. But there's some interesting information that I'm going to give you now that I don't know how much stock to put in it. In other words, I don't want you leaving here and say, "Dan told us exactly when Jesus was born." In fact, I know the day and the time and everything about it. But it is also fascinating. And so I wanted to share that with you. So We are in the period here in Revelation in the seventh trumpet. Back in chapter 11 and verse 15, the seventh angel sounded the trumpet and there were loud voices. Now, the seventh trumpet would have brought to any Jewish person's mind the seventh festival of the year, which was Rosh Hashanah, which took place in the first day of the seventh month. And that was the day that began the biblical year for the Jews. For us, that's the month of, is Hebrew month is Tishri. It's our September, October. And each of the seven festival months began with a trumpet sounding on the first day. And the seventh month on the first day, which is Tishri, which is Rosh Hashanah, that's the month kings had their final coronation ceremony. That's the month the Jews believed then and still believe today that the world was created in. And all of that would come to the mind of a Jew as they're reading this because when it was mentioning the seventh trumpet, Rosh Hashanah was a new beginning. I don't have it down here, but everybody celebrated their birthday on Rosh Hashanah. That's when you got 1 year older. Isn't that nice? Everybody shared the same birthday. Even if you weren't born on that day, that's when you celebrated it. So Virgo is the ruling constellation in the previous month, not in Tishri, but in Elul, which is the sixth month. And it goes from August to September. And that constellation is followed by Libra in Tishri, in the seventh month. Libra is the woman with the scales, okay? And the scales of Libra were also viewed by the ancients as being a dragon, that it was a dragon there as well, and the claws of Scorpio were the dragon. Thus, what you're seeing here in this constellation is the dragon of Libra reaching for Virgo, who you can still see, but the sun's not passing through that particular constellation anymore, or at least in this sense. So you see the constellation of the dragon reaching for Virgo, and so in astral symbolism, the birth of the Messiah took place on the day of the trumpets, which would be Tishri 1, the first day of Tishri. Listen, luckily for us, because the universe is a clock, and astronomers can tell you the position of the stars and the sun and the moon at any given time from any given place on Earth and from the viewpoint of Palestine, where this would be taking place. The sun's path entered the head of Virgo on August 13th and left her feet on October 2nd. And so it would have been there that she would have been clothed with the sun in between those two dates. So mid-body of the constellation is a 20-day period of each year from August 27th to September 15th. And the writer gives us one more astronomical clue, and that is the moon. And where is the moon in the constellation at this point? It's at her feet. The moon is under the feet of Virgo just one day out of Tishri. And in fact, that day, in fact, it's there for just 2 hours on that day, from 6:15 in the evening to 7:45 in the evening. And that day is September 11th, 3 BC. That's 2 years before Herod the Great died. It's within the time frame of when he ordered the babies to be killed in Bethlehem. And so sundown on September 11th, 3 BC, was Tishri 1, the day of the trumpets of Rosh Hashanah. And so, is that Jesus' birthday? Astronomically, according to this, it works. Again, don't run out of here and quote me that Dan told us when Jesus was born. But symbolically, that was when it happened. And it does fit historically. Yes.
Historically, when they're out in the fields with the sheep,
yeah. They would still be out in the fields. It's not wintertime. Tim, did you have, yes, Daniel?
My only thought as a way of, I don't know, maybe checking this, is the fact that, I mean, nobody would be able to make this connection until near, like, recent history, when we could observe the pattern of the stars and know where constellations are during the day.
Right.
So when, you know, when we say, oh, well, the sun would be right in the middle of this constellation, well, they didn't know that. They didn't have any way of tracking that. Right. So, but then we know.
Well, I don't know that you can say that because, I mean, you look at Stonehenge and all that. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that has to do with a astronomical calendar, and I think they knew a lot more than we did about stuff like that. Yes.
But we also are forgetting that they were paying attention to the King Star. So the King Star was what was guiding the three wise men during that time.
Right.
So that one, that King Star, that hung around Jupiter for that time, and that's a phenomenon that happens once every, I don't know, a couple thousand years or something, supposedly.
Yeah, and I know people have said that about the star. The issue that I have with that is that the star came and stood over the manger. And so they found the manger because...
Yeah,
and listen, I can't even follow a rainbow. You know, I see a rainbow and I see where it's in. I keep going over there and it keeps moving on me. So I think that that was truly a supernatural phenomenon of that star, the star there that was used that. So anyway, it fascinated me that the woman is described this way, with clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and the 12 stars around her head and when it was a Rosh Hashanah and all that. Anyway, I just had to share that with you. So then we have another sign appearing, and that's in verses 3 and 4. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. So we have this this great, let me move this over here. I got behind on my computer here. This great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns. Now, I want you to look at Daniel chapter 7 and verses 3 through 7. This will take us 2 slides here to do this. 4 great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. Listen, that's Nebuchadnezzar in reverse. Nebuchadnezzar was a man who was turned into a beast. And in this line, we have a beast being turned into a man. Both of them unnatural and yucky. Anyway, so but the first one is a lion. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth. And between its teeth, it was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. Let me move this one along. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had 4 wings, like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Now, if we go back, and I'll just do this up here. If I go back, how many heads do we have on these beasts total? How many on the lion? 1. How many on the bear? How many on the leopard? 4. Add them up. How many is that? 6. And then we have this other great beast that has, so 1 more. So that's 7. So we have 7 heads. And I assume that they're all crowned. So I can have 7 crowns. But how many horns do we have in total?
10.
We have 10. Which is on this last one. He's got 10 horns. So, I think what we're seeing is a kind of conglomeration of the beasts of Daniel 7 here. And though different, these visions are, I think, about the same thing. We're talking about the Babylonian and the Medo-Persian and the Greek and the Roman empires. which were all stages of the dragon's attempt to establish his rule on the earth. Satan is the great beast that these were partial images of. And in fact, in Daniel's vision here, as he moves on with this, the beasts are going to be removed. The kingdom of God is going to be given to the son of... Let me say it again. The beasts are removed and the kingdom is given to the son of man. Man and beast, that's the differentiation here by the Ancient of Days. And so this vision that we have in Revelation 12 is parallel to that one in Daniel. All right, so I'm going to stop here and do some, for you, some biblical dragonology. I know that you're excited about that. Megan has on her car, her license plate holder says, "It's okay, dragons don't believe in you either." So I don't even know why I told you that. So there are three kinds of dragons in the Bible. The first one is the Tannin, T-A-N-N-I-N. And in Psalm 91:13, "Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion, and the Tannin," the dragon. Most of your translations probably have serpent there, but it is Tannin. "Shalt thou trample under feet." Then there is Leviathan from Psalm 104 and verse 26. "There go the ships, there is that Leviathan whom thou hast made to play therein." And then the third one is Rahab. And by the way, when I say Rahab, do not think of the woman in the book of Joshua. They're not even the same word in Hebrew. And they're here in Job 26, 12 through 13. "He divides the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smites through the proud. By his spirit he hath garnished the heavens. His hand hath formed the crooked serpent." And so again, this is the third kind of dragon. When we come into the garden in Genesis 3, what form does the serpent... Well, why don't I just give you the answer? That Satan comes in. It's in the form of a serpent. Go over... I don't know if I have this up there. Yes. So here's Moses God had Moses throw down his staff when he was trying to convince him to go, and what did it turn into? Turned into a serpent. Here is where Aaron does that. And when Pharaoh says to him, "Perform a miracle," then say to Aaron, "Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake." In this particular case, this is the word Tannin that is going to be that. And so, listen, all of this is showing God's power over Satan and over the serpent. Egypt is called in Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 7, "To Egypt, whose help is utterly useless, therefore I call her Rahab, the do-nothing." The do-nothing dragon is Egypt. It has no power. It can't help anybody. And then when you look at the Exodus itself in Psalm 74, verses 13 through 14, "It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave it as food to the creatures of the desert." And so there, the Exodus for salvation, the thing that was taken out was Leviathan. Now, so those are the three dragons that we read about in the Old Testament, the three words that are used for that. Now, you'll recall, I don't want to go all the way back there. If you can open your Bibles back up to Isaiah chapter 26. I should have just copied that up there, and I didn't. So I want to make sure I didn't do that. I'll do that for the Zoom class tomorrow night. It's a good warm-up for teaching them. In Isaiah chapter 26, verses 17 and 18, I read this just a moment ago. If I get to Isaiah instead of Jeremiah, right? Isaiah chapter 26, verses 17 and 18. "Lord came," as a woman, is that right? 17 and 18, is that what I'm supposed to be reading? Yes. As a woman with child about to give birth rise and cries out in her pain, so were we in your presence, O Lord. I pointed that out. Verse 18, we were with child, we writhed in pain, but we gave birth to wind. We have brought salvation to the earth. We have not given birth to the people of the world. So here is the woman about to give birth, but now I do have this passage up there, Isaiah 27 and 1, the first part of the very next chapter. In that day, the Lord will punish with his sword, his fierce and great and powerful sword, Leviathan, the gliding serpent, Leviathan, the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea. And so in the process of bringing the child forth and the woman giving birth, right after that happens, the Leviathan, the dragon, is destroyed. Now, if we get back to Revelation now in chapter 12, as we look a little deeper at the dragon here that has come up, you'll notice that in verse 4, his tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. So let me get that picture back up there again, and you can see that the stars in his tail are being swept away. And these stars, I think, in this particular context, represent the fallen angels. And two passages that talk about that. And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority in Jude, but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. And then 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment. And so that's the third of the stars that were taken away. So why one third?
Because that's how many that the devil deceived out of heaven.
Okay, but why one third? What, if one third is taken away, what do I have left? I have two thirds. And if you're the firstborn, what do you get?
Double
you get a double portion. And so a double portion of them were retained for the Son of God. He kept double of what he lost there. And so for every false witness Satan musters, it appears that there are two who stand in rebuttal of those false witnesses. And the goal of the dragon from the beginning has been to abort the will of God, to contradict the word of Christ. And so what we see him doing in Revelation 12 here is he's standing in front of the woman who is about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment he was born. So he's standing before the woman waiting to devour the child. Even in Genesis 3, who is the serpent standing before? Eve. He's standing before the woman. And in fact, in Genesis 3, we have the war announced. I will put enmity, speaking to the serpent, between you and the woman, and between your Satan, your offspring, and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. So the war is announced there. And listen, if you just sat there and tried to picture what we see in Revelation 12 of the dragon sitting in front of this woman who's about to give birth just so he can eat the child as soon as it's born, pretty gruesome. Pretty gut-wrenching picture. And so, it's pop quiz time for you, because I can do this now because we have live people here and I'll have live people there. Can you think of examples in history where the dragon tried to symbolically devour the child? And if you can think of one, raise your hand. Yes?
So you talk about the child being Jesus. Is that where the child is?
Am I thinking about what?
Is the child Jesus?
Yes.
Okay.
So you went right to the climax of the whole story. But yes, I mean, that is the climax. That's the final picture of this picture. Is the Jesus being trying to be killed as an infant. Okay? So let's back up in history. Okay, Jonathan?
Are you thinking biblical history? Or?
Yeah, yeah. That's all I'm interested in.
Egypt chasing Israel to the Red Sea.
Pardon me?
Egypt chasing Israel to the Red Sea.
Okay. So Egypt trying to keep them in bondage and killing them. Yes?
Well,
Okay. Okay. Roger?
Pharaoh killing the firstborn.
Okay, so Pharaoh killing all of the male babies. That's the seed. Okay, so excellent. Randy, did you have one?
Herod did the same thing when Jesus was born.
Okay. Okay. Tammy?
And so it's not a slaying, but trying to have Ishmael be the son.
Okay. Okay, yes. Well, yeah, we're trying to not a daughter of Sarah, or son of Sarah. Yes.
Not sure, but it kind of seems like it when David went up against Goliath and kind of that, like the large enemy.
Yes, that's a good example. I didn't have one. That is an excellent one, because Goliath was obviously a servant of the serpent, and challenging the seed of Abraham, any one of them to come out. Yes?
Would it be safe to assume that any major culture that tried to overtake the world would basically fall under this category?
Well, yeah, because as we saw a minute ago, all of these beasts were emanations of the serpent trying to control the world. Yeah. Yes, Ross?
Was it Josiah that was the only one saved when,
Okay, so when Athaliah tried to kill the royal seed, and that's in 2 Chronicles 22, there's another example of the dragon sitting there trying to kill the lineage. Did you have one, Riley?
Satan trying to test and get rid of Job's blessings from God.
Okay, okay, yes. When he was making, nobody will follow you. Yeah, that's a good one. Mike?
Well, when David was chased off the throne, but it was by his son, so it would still be his lineage.
Yes, yeah, but he's not the lineage that's going to come through, but yes. I would actually, in a different way, look at it from, that's more of the birth pains of David's sin with Bathsheba and trying to get him, to get David off of the throne himself. So here's a few more. Cain killing Abel. And Seth took his place. And in Genesis, the 6th chapter, we have the death of all of Seth's line, except for Noah and his household. We have two different times when Sarah was taken from Abram and virtually almost raped by Gentile kings, and God wouldn't allow it. Same thing happened to Rebekah and Abimelech, and Isaac, followed his father's footsteps. Tim, are you just scratching your chin, or you have something?
Well, I was just thinking of once when God sort of maybe got Satan's attention was when Abraham to kill Isaac.
Okay. Yeah, well, and of course Abraham knew that God could raise him from the dead, but yes, the temptation not to do that would have been great. Somebody already mentioned Egypt, Pharaoh killing all the male children. Saul's attempt to kill David on two different occasions. Athaliah, somebody mentioned that it was Ross. How about Haman's attempt to kill all of the Jews in Esther? I mean, to wipe out the whole nation. There's all of the idolatrous attempts to get the Jews to offer their children as burnt offerings to Molech and some other idol gods. Listen, these are all part of the war between his offspring and her seed. And of course, it all comes to a climax, and that's the one that really stands out, when Herod tried to kill Jesus at his birth and killed all the young boys of two and under. And of course, later, when Satan has got Jesus and tempting him, what does he tell him to do up on the temple pinnacle? Jump off. Commit suicide. And Jesus said, I'm not going to tempt the Lord my God. And listen, if we read Genesis, the 3rd chapter in verse 15, before all of this started, we already know who's going to win, don't we? The seed of woman is going to win, because it's going to crush the head of the serpent. And actually, that's kind of a familiar motif throughout the Bible, as an enemy being killed by a woman. Sisera's armies were defeated by a woman. Sisera himself was killed by a woman, Jael. Drove a tent peg through his head. The death of Abimelech in chapter 9 and verse 53, a woman threw a something over the side, a millstone. Esther's defeat of Haman. I mean, that's a recurring picture that you see in the scriptures as well. All right, I didn't bring a pin up there, but we're going to stop right there at verses 5 and 6. Yes, just toss it to me. I think I can still catch. I'm just going to mark it so they don't. Can you catch? There you go. Very good. I knew we weren't going to get very far tonight because just I had so much exciting stuff. Okay, and so we'll start with verses 5 and 6 when the woman actually gives birth to the child and what happens through that. And I told Robin I was going to, I was, in fact, I'm going to